Welcome back to the Barred Window. It's brilliant to have all your company again. And today I've got a real treat for you. I'm going to be talking to Linda Saunders, who is an extremely well-known and prize-winning poet. She's going to read at least five of her poems today, and all the details of them will be on the front page, on the text. And in the middle of it, we're going to have a chat about poetry generally. But welcome, Linda. Nice to have you.
Thank you. And thank you for calling me a treat.
Well, you are. You are. I think your poetry is lovely. So we're going to let everybody hear it, I hope, now. And I think let's just get straight into it. So the first poem you're going to read is called Entrusted. Would you just say a little about it and then read it, please?
Yeah, this is a very recent poem which came from a really extraordinary experience to me, in that this tiny blue butterfly approached and landed on my finger and allowed itself not only to be looked at closely, to be photographed too. Wow. I got my phone and photographed it there. But this is the kind of experience that really invites me as a poet to want to describe it precisely.
Right.
And I think this is key to me in writing poetry. And I think to other poets, they want to find words that are true to a particular experience, descriptively true and true to the feeling. It's called Entrusted.
Thank you.
A sliver of light, flitting above the lawn, weaving, wavering, never quite deciding to settle. Fainting as if to baffle a predator, or searching the air for some sweet pheromone. A holly blue. If I look away, it must vanish, but now flirts around me, a flake of sky, dancing a net to hold me captive, then alights on my hand, nails me with its pale blue sail. Silvered azure with a sheen of turquoise, colour alive, never to be believed till now, as I dare bring it even closer to examine banded antennae, a pepper of black dots on folded wings, smaller than my fingertip, sipping salt from my skin. It investigates my strangeness with no apparent notion beyond its own need and moment of the gift it entrusts to the human. Intimate and rare, remote as a signal from a star, I feel the tickle of its footsteps.
Lovely. Thank you very much. I think, before we talk more, I would like to hear another, if that's all right with you. And I believe you've got a poem there called Lifer that actually got third prize in the Wells Festival of Literature.
Yes, yes.
A little about it and then read it for us?
Well, this is another poem which comes from my love of natural history and living things, and particularly things with wings. This is about a little bird whose name will be told towards the end of the poem. I reserve it for them.
Right.
Lifer. We used to think it a mad sparrow before we learned it was the last migrant to return, and its name explained what it was up to, flipping off a post or a low-slung branch with flight controls seemingly gone haywire. Today, here's the first, hunched at the ready on the tallest tombstone in the graveyard. Overhead, against a washed sky brushed by feathery remnants of rain cloud, swifts are scything the wind, returned only last week for their circus of high-flown love. For our soul's health, we need to go on gazing. Stopped in our tracks and sorrows to mark the arrivals of birds that cross the world above our news and wars, our migrations of loss. long-haul passerines with their songs of summer, the swifts 24/7 on the wing. Birders call their first ever sighting of a species new to them a lifer. For me, each returning migrant is a lifer again, somehow newer still in renewing each first of every summer down the years. Harbingers of memory, human and avian, surely ancestral. Yet only this moment recalled as exquisitely. Wing tilt and flecked feather, the lilt of its whistle. My heart always somersaults as crazily as the spotted flycatcher, plying his skill under the churchyard yews, like a spirit liberated from the earth below, skittish with surprise and quite loopy with life, this fling of resurrection.
That was delightful. Thank you. The spotted flycatcher, yeah. I bet that was thrilling to see.
Unfortunately, they have seen a great drop in numbers over the last 3 or 4 years. Mm. And I'm very concerned, you know, as we all are, about the thinning of species, about the loss of biodiversity.
Sadly, and, yes.
And that's why I've called the first poem Entrusted. I want to get across that these things are a gift to us. They're entrusted to us. And there's an irony in that it's a gift entrusted to the human.
Well, at least you've taken a word photograph of it. And I think that's...
I don't want it to remain as a word photograph. In fact, then I've seen a lot in the garden this year, but the rareness of the feeling was extraordinary.
Okay, let's just pause for a second. Because I want to talk about a little bit about your evolution, if you like, into poetry and into being such a successful poet. Because previously, you were an arts journalist, and you were shortlisted for the Arts Journalist of the Year. You were a member of the International Association of Art Critics. I mean, a fine arts journalist and editor. So can you talk about your evolution into poetry?
Well, I think it started a long way back, really.
Always there in the background.
I think the people who write poetry have always kind of loved language and words. And I did from a start. I loved spelling out words. I liked playing with them as a child, the sound and the feel of them in my mouth. And I loved there were early poems that entranced me with their rhyme and their music. And they suggested a magical world, even if it wasn't magical, but they often were with children's poetry. I loved poems like Up the Airy Mountain, Down the Rushy Glen, We Don't Go Hunting for Fear of Little Men. I can't remember who it was, someone who said that there is another world and it is in this one. I think that I got that from poetry very early. And I later learned to love the magical elements in Coleridge and The Ancient Mariner, Kubla Khan, Christabel. And as a teenager, I fell in love with Shelley for his ideas and for the extraordinary romance of his life, tragic romance of his life. And then I think I wrote poetry off and on, not consistently. I wanted to be a writer. Hmm. I wrote a novel, and I fussed so much in the end with the prose and the way the sentences shaped and the words. I had to conclude that maybe I was a poet. But it wasn't until much later that I started finding how difficult and how disciplined poetry has to be, which is makes it more attractive to me. And it's only when I retired myself from my work as a journalist, which was writing, that I found time to approach things differently and to really finish poems and get them published.
And it sounds like you had multiple influences. I mean, and if I might just quickly, Philip Cross wrote of your poetry that you applied words to subtle experiences as a painter might use paint, for their texture, their balance and tone, with attention to each brush stroke. Now, that attention to small details is something that I know that you feel that drives you as well. Is that fair?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, I think that was a lovely thing that Philip Gross said, actually. I did come to that kind of writing as well, because I am very visual, I think. Mm. And I had a lot of training actually looking at art as a fine arts journalist and talking to painters and artists.
Well, your first collection was shortlisted for the Gerwood Aldeburgh Prize, I believe.
Yes, that was a surprise.
And that must have been quite encouraging, your very first collection actually getting sort of quite a recognition like that.
There were about five people shortlisted, and the winner, in fact, is now a very well-known Faber poet.
Okay.
Yes, it was quite exciting at the time. It was quite suspenseful because we didn't know the results from a month or two. So you could have this fantasy that you would actually make that prize. But it was an honour. I was very pleased.
Well, it is. These are prestigious competitions. And talking about
my publisher sent the book in, submitted the book for the prize. So that was nice. Yeah.
So talking about prize-winning competitions, I'd like you to read the next poem, please, which is called Outside Chance, which got first prize in another prestigious competition, the Teignmouth Poetry Festival. So would you read Outside Chance for us?
Yes, this is the poem. The unnamed person in it is my father, he meant a great deal to me. I didn't really know him as a grown-up. He died when I was just barely gone past 20. So all my memories of him were childhood memories. Mm. And he was a very fanciful kind of character. He was very charming. I absolutely adored him. But I actually believed him when he said he had this dream of a crowd yelling the name of a horse. Oh. So he found it in the racing columns and put rather a large sum for him in those days on it.
Right.
Outside chance. Baby wants new shoes, he'd say. To give a lift to a small flutter each way on a horse he'd wised up on in the racing columns. But once he put all of £5 to win, and did, on an outsider, Burlington Arcade. Having dreamed himself among a wild crowd yelling its name at the finishing line, it was the sole evidence he could ever claim for divine or psychic intervention on behalf of any need of babies or his own. Just chance, he thought it, when a shell slammed down beside him on the battlefield and did not explode, while the world paused as he said goodbye to it. Age 17, he'd lied about his age to volunteer, then found his glasses by another miracle and put them on to look into the future. What is the difference between luck and grace? His golfer's swing was an action of honed grace, preceded by a moment of stillness, something like prayer. Club raised on high, as if to align himself with every quick nuance of this world's here and there. The sky's depths, each inflected shadow, tilt of wind and wish towards a promised land. Among his silver trophies on the sideboards, sharing the pride with ebony elephants paraded trunk to tail, were the egg cups awarded in those days for a hole-in-one. A stroke of grace, I'd say, in league with luck, that the shell didn't kill him, as was the perfect loft and flight he gave a ball that landed sweetly on the green and trickled home.
Hmm. very, very evocative and obviously very personal too. But that does thread through your poetry, doesn't it? Because we're going to read some more, hear some more in a minute that are reflective of the deep feelings for your own family, your mother and your sons as well.
I do tend to write about people I care very deeply about, as well as other things, of course. Yes.
Mm. Well, I mean, you say your father, you lost him when you were 20. Was he a poet into poetry?
He used to tell me those wonderfully inventive stories. But I don't know that he was a poet, no.
Mm.
No, he wasn't.
Mm. I'm just wondering if there was any influences from within the family. I mean, and the next poem that I'm going to ask you to read is called Sideways, but it's principally about your mother, I believe.
Well, yes. This is a poem, as I say in the little line that starts, it was a poem that started from a line by another poet, in this case, Jack Gilbert, the American poet, whose mm-hmm. work I love.
Mm-hmm.
And this is often a device that poets sometimes use. They take a line out of a poem and then they take it somewhere else, like Paul Clay taking a line for a walk. But this walk, it was kind of, I just wanted to explore the idea of sideways and starting from the idea of words being the poet's project, searching for the right true word that, as I say in the poem, the word that will tend his passion. But the idea of sideways, I didn't know this poem was going to be about my mother. And yet that's what it became. And it moved me very greatly that I discovered my mother in this way.
How interesting.
Shall I read it?
Yes, I was going to say, let's hear it.
Yes, sideways. And the first phrase is the phrase from Jack Gilbert. We use them sideways. Words, he meant, that will do for now. Slipping them through or between to prize away towards what we don't yet know how to say. My mother cut sideways through water. She'd swim in any weather, any sea, her right cheek pillowed on the waves. Once she hooked back a man from drowning, brought him to shore on her strong side stroke, legs scissoring the undertow. Tacking is a strategy of cunning, making headway in adversity, catching the gale sideways and using it. After the stroke, she was often lost for a word. She, the linguist who loved a cryptic crossword, I took the slant of her meaning and how she strove by indirection to arrive at it, like a small craft in a contrary wind. Some things, faintest stars, we see more brightly if we just look glancingly. So a mist, a smudge, resolves itself into points of light, sidereal in the corner of the eye. It's the way our eyes are made, near the edge, more densely receptive, so we always have this sense of what escapes our scrutiny, a truth askance and faceted, a love so far unsaid. Almost, she said once, exhausted, gripping both my hands and waiting, like the poet, for the word that will tend his passion. Then hooking the prize at last with an intake of wonder, inexhaustible, which was about the size of it.
Very, very good. I love that. Really evocative. I mean, I love the cheek pillowing on the waves. Just the whole imagery that you managed to conjure up there.
Tacking, incidentally, as most people will know, is what you do in a sailboat. When the wind is against you, you move in zigzags sideways. That memory of when she was dying and this word came out of her, inexhaustible, it was so amazing. And that, you know, I had to write about that eventually. And it just happened through this poem.
You said that you didn't realise it was about your mother until you were well into it.
No, I just started writing about sideways, and it immediately reminded me of my mother's side stroke in the ocean.
Wow. All right, well, before we read another one or two, I always ask poets on the programme just their views, if you like, about the importance of poetry, because it's still, no matter what, appears to many in the general public to be a kind of a niche activity that's not perhaps as widely appreciated as it could be. Is that fair, or do you have another view?
I think there is so much competing against poetry now in the, you know, the digital online world. And poets are bound to believe that poetry and what they do is important. And I do believe it very sincerely. I think it was Li Po, the ancient Chinese poet, I may have got this wrong, but he said that poetry is a way to live twice. And to me and to poets, it's a way of, it's about attention, attending very keenly and intently to experience and to life. And the poet feels into his own personal experience, and we all have this area. You know, we all are looking out through our totally individual eyes. And he wants to give that personal experience another life in words. And this is quite hard, I think, for many people nowadays to discover. There have been all sorts of movements and occasions for people wanting to make poetry more accessible to a wider audience. You've just got to remember Wordsworth, who determined to use language, that the language of the common man. And Mary Oliver said something marvellous about poetry. She said that she said many marvellous things about poetry, but she distinguishes the language of poetry from informational language. She says that poetry, the language of poetry, has shadows.
Yes.
I was always interested in shadows. And also, another poet who I admire greatly is John Burnside, and he has said that it reminds of the invisible behind the visible.
Right.
And this is quite hard to perceive in the modern noise and clutter of the world, the very commercial world. It's like trying to hear the delicate music of a flute, in that great cacophony, which is the modern life.
Well, your poetry has been described as modulated as a fine piece of music.
Oh.
Just to say.
Really?
Yeah,
that'd be good.
Yes, I've read that. Now, also, I'd like to bring up the point of that you yourself have talked about exploring, and the phrase here I've got is the uniqueness of every feeling, every memory, every observation. And that goes back to your attention to detail and your love of detail. And it almost sounded to me, it's hugely impressive, but it also sounds to me forensic. Is that a fair assessment?
That's forensic is a very scientific and technical world, but I think the writer of poetry has to be a bit forensic. That some are more forensically obsessive than others, and I think I can obsess about the comma or a dash or a line break, like, you know, forever. That's why it takes so long to read, to write a poem. It also takes, I want to make this point, actually, it takes a long time to read a poem too. Yes. You know, you don't get it at first reading. And I think it's very important for it to be sounded out in the mouth.
Well, I hope for people listening, they realise that we're going to publish your poetry on the website. So, I mean, they can read it as many times as they like after listening to you. And I'm sure that on each reading, people will, as usual, get just a little bit more.
But this is what poetry requires, and which is, I think, is tremendously healing and helpful to our neglected souls. Oh. I don't use the word souls in a kind of religious sense, but this area of our life, which we all need to nurture. And we nurture this with art and creative work as well, I think, being creative. And actually, a lot of people now are turning to writing poetry as a creative aspect of their lives. This is very interesting. People miss that element in their lives, and it's taking off. I think if poetry does need, you know, for the flute to be heard, it needs to attract attention. I agree, but it needs to do so in a curious and haunting way, so that people pause and listen, and take time to read the poem and think, ah, you know.
I think it must capture attention straight away, almost. I mean, people are of that the attention spans of many people, and I don't mean established poetry lovers. I mean others that you want to influence and to enjoy poetry.
Yeah. The only thing that apparently holds attention span for a long period of time is the screen. But actually, you know, I think poetry has to take this into account. You know, its traditional medium is the spoken voice. And then books, then with print and books became its medium. And which doesn't mean to say that I think books are irrelevant or peripheral, far from it, any more than, you know, the beauty of books has been sidelined by online text. It hasn't. People love these things. The tactile quality, the beauty of books, even more. And poetry is involved in that. It's on the page as well. But I think poetry is beginning in an innovative way to use the media, the other media. It's got more of a presence on screen. It uses imagery and music to enhance words. And this is fine by me. I think, you know, we don't know where it's going to go. It still has to retain some kind of hold on our imagination.
That's quite exciting in some ways, though, not knowing which way it's going to go. Let me ask you, before we get to the final poem, can I just ask a couple of questions? And that's as much for people who are listening as myself. I would also like to know how you actually go about writing. Do you just throw something down straight away and then spend ages refining it? Or are you a very detailed, right from the first line, poet?
I find that a poem that I want to write is kind of brewing in. There are things I want to write about, and it takes me ages. I don't actually sort of start thinking about them. And sometimes they are triggered by something else, you know, so these two ideas rub together. And then when I start writing a poem, I usually start somewhere, as it were, like I did with Sideways. But I know what I think. I think I know what I want to write about. But very often, the poem, writing the poem, is a discovery of what I'm really up to. And using the words and the way the words discover the meaning, you're searching for the right word and a new word pops up and that discovers meaning. And I love that process. I'm very interested in the process. But I usually write a first draft at more or less one sitting, which may be several hours. I get really I forget where I am, into a kind of zone. Then I start fidgeting, scribbling on it, because I always write in longhand at first. and then I transfer it to the computer so I can see what it looks like on the page. Yeah. And I, you know, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
And a long time after that, I go on fidgeting with it and making adjustments and revising, which is very important. You're kind of discovering the poem again in the poem that you've created. You're sort of opening up the cracks and finding a better word here and there.
Let's imagine that one of our listeners is somebody that hasn't written any poetry before, and they're listening to yourself and reading other poets who are, I would call, established, I would call excellent poets, I would call prize-winning poets, which you are. And they might sit and think, well, goodness, I could never do that. That's just, you know, incredible. I mean, you know, how could I be a poet of that quality? How could I get on with poetry? Why should I even start? What would you say to them?
I say that I feel that before every poem.
Hmm.
I don't know. I think it was Ian Forster who said, people say, where does it come from? And he said that he doesn't know where it comes from. You know, heaven only knows. And sometimes, I think, no, remember that Browning said, you know, what, someone asked what Browning, what a poet meant. He said, well, I knew what it meant when I wrote it. Now, God only knows.
Fair point.
It's as if it comes from somewhere else, was the impression.
Oh.
But you do it by doing it. That's the thing for an experience.
And enjoy it. I mean, I would also say surely enjoy it, because, I mean, people who really get kind of tripped up with angst or whatever, just, you know, there's no enjoyment in it sometimes.
Well, I find it's very hard somehow to make myself start to write a poem, you know. I do all sorts of diversionary activities instead of writing. And then when I start, when I'm on the trail, as it were, it's totally absorbing. But it's quite difficult to start. And I think that's the key, is put your pen on your paper.
But with all your books and all the prize winners you've had and the poems we've heard and the ones we'll read again too, I mean, thank you for starting, I should say. Let's get to the last one, because we're nearly out of time. And this is another family one, personal one, about one of your sons who is an astronomer, I believe.
I chose to read this one after the one about my mother, because of this reference to seeing things out of the corner of your eye, this little smudge, which becomes, if you look at the sky and at the Pleiades, for example, which is a smudge of stars, but if you look out of the corner of your eye, or try to see it instead of focusing, they say you get this kind of sense of these little dots. And my son, who was a keen amateur astronomer, told me that this is called the astronomer's vision.
Ah.
When I was in the States visiting my other son, I bought him this T-shirt. I've got a lovely photograph of him wearing it, which keeps popping up on my screen. It's called Awesome, because he uses this word. Awesome. His smile on my screensaver keeps beaming in above the Milky Way on that T-shirt I found at the Monterey Aquarium and brought back across 6,000 miles of Earth and ocean. He's worn it and worn it. Our home galaxy floating luminous on ultramarine, with the arrow pointing, you are here, northwest of his heart. From the back garden, he finds Mars for me. October small hours, conditions perfect, near invisible scrim of cloud to cut the star glare. You'll have to be quick, he says, to glimpse the faint smudge of Syrtis Major like an upside-down Y, and the South Pole tilting its bright spot of ice towards us. I stoop over the eyepiece and catch just a tiny cell sliding already out of the scope's slim beam of vision. The planet, no bigger than the pupil of an eye, but closer than it's been for years, and I've lost it. Awesome, breathes my son, the astronomer, as he tracks it again across 35 million miles. His anorak gapes open on those glowing words, "You are here."
Lovely. Linda, thanks. I'm afraid time's caught up with us a bit. But it's been, I mean, for me, it's been delightful listening to you. I have read your poetry before, but I mean, hearing you, it's just excellent. And I'm certain that the listeners to the podcast will agree with me.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a very indulgent experience for me just to read some of my poems and jabber about them.
Well, you know, you're not only are you very welcome, but I mean, I think it was a treat, as I said at the beginning, for me. And I hope for others too. So, Linda Saunders, thank you. And as I said, to everything that you've said and all the links that you've mentioned, we will make sure that they're on the front page and that people can continue to enjoy your work for a long time to come. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you in turn. Thank you.